Howard Schultz revolutionized coffee culture nationally and internationally by laying claim to what he called a third place between home and work, called Starbucks. But his global company has been undergoing some serious economic problems, forcing him to close 600 stores in the U.S. alone in the upcoming months. In an article in the July issue of Condé Nast Portfolio called Tall Order, David Margalek, who is a contributing editor to the magazine and the author of four books, looks at what Mr. Schultz can do to stop the failing fortunes of Starbucks. And I'm very pleased that it has brought David back to the show. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Leonard.
And you cover a wide territory. Last time you were here, we were talking about Billie Holiday.
Yeah, it's sort of nice to be talking about something that's going on in the current decade.
How much credit should Howard Schultz get for building the Starbucks empire?
Oh, I think he should get almost all the credit. I mean, he was the visionary who saw the market for a fancier line of coffee. He sort of saw American taste changing. You know, he was the one that spotted this opening for a more sophisticated kind of coffee consumption. I'm envious of him because I went to Italy 30 years ago and fell in love with it, but I didn't come back and start Starbucks. That's what he did.
But he didn't start Starbucks. He's like Ray Kroc and McDonald's. Somebody else started it, and then he took it to another level.
Well, that's technically right. But I mean, he started when he took over Starbucks, there were only five stores. You know, it was just a pretty much a Seattle coffee boutique. So, yes, he didn't technically start it, but he was the one that expanded it exponentially in the way that it was done.
And without franchising it.
And without franchising it. They own all of their own stores.
So when did he give up the job of company CEO to become chairman and chief global strategist?
I think it was 2000 or 2001.
And then he decided to take back the CEO job?
Well, you know, he never really let it go. If you talk to people, and he had people nominally who were running the place day to day, but he, you know, his presence was very much felt there. If you went to the annual meeting, he was the impresario that always presented the latest triumphant sales returns. I mean, he was, I think, always calling. No, you know, it's hard to resist the puns here, but he was always the one who was calling the shots.
There was a cartoon in the Sunday Times about Starbucks closing some of the stores, and this guy said, "Oh, they're going to close the store next to us, but we'll have to walk down to the end of the alley."
Yeah, and they showed like eight different Starbucks all in one panel, and that's very much the world that they created. They thought that it was infinitely expandable, that you could just keep opening one next door to another one, and the market seemed to be infinite.
How many businesses do they have and how many employees?
I think, you know, I'm a little bit rusty on the figures by now. I think it's something like 170,000 employees, and they have 11,000 stores in the U.S.
So they'll be closing 600 stores, and that puts about 12,000 of those employees at risk.
Yeah, that's right, which is something that's never happened before. They had previously announced that they were going to close 100 stores, but then they added 500 more on top of that.
Well, on the way to work today, I decided to stop in at the local Starbucks and get a cup of coffee as a matter of research.
Right.
And there was a very long line.
Mm-hmm.
So is it those kinds of stores that are closing?
It's generally the stores that have been open for a year or less. It's the last ones that they open generally that they're closing. And they're closing them in California and Florida. They're closing them where the real estate market has been the hardest hit. They were much more careful about their real estate decisions early on. And I think that they just got kind of greedy in a way and opened stores more profligately than they had before. And those are it's last hired, first fired sort of thing.
More likely to be in the suburbs?
More likely to be where they were cannibalizing existing stores, and more likely to be in Sunbelt places that were affected by the real estate market, more likely to be newer places. I went to a Starbucks in Bridgehampton the other day. In fact, I did a follow-up on my portfolio story for the portfolio website. And there was a very nice crowd of people coming in there. It was a very pleasant place to sit. It was very established, very comfortable. That's not the kind of place they're going to close.
When did they go international?
They went international, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago.
So how many countries are they in?
I think that they're in 30 or 40 countries now.
Wow, which strikes me as odd because there are so many different standards for what makes good coffee all over the world.
Well, this is where they see their market now. I mean, they have not cut back much on their international expansion, and they see this, I think, in the near term as the future of Starbucks. And it's interesting that what Schultz told me is that, you know, there's all this clamor here to change the stores and to upgrade them and make them more regional and all of this. And he said that overseas, people just want the authentic Starbucks pure experience. It's an American thing. It's like McDonald's, although that's an image that he would very much resent, a comparison that he does not like at all.
And McDonald's does go local. And it's a franchise operation.
Right. And so they want the vintage Starbucks experience. He did open places even in Italy. I mean, even in places where the coffee is good, there still is, in Paris as well, people still want the American experience.
But he won't open stores in the Hamptons or Israel.
Well, what I was surprised when he told me this, actually. As far as the Hamptons, he said initially he didn't want to open stores in the Hamptons, because that's where he spends his summer. He has a house in East Hampton, and he just didn't want to be reminded of work. But he's first and foremost a businessman, and he did open them in the Hamptons, including the one that I went to the other day. There are several in the Hamptons, and I think in the long run he's happy that he opened them there. He did also open some stores in Israel, but they didn't last very long. The stores overseas are partnerships. They're franchises. They make deals with local business people. The official story is that it didn't work out in Israel and they moved out and they're looking for another partner eventually. But there's also a suspicion in some circles that the Arab market is much larger than the Israeli market, and therefore he's not eager to get back into Israel.
Who are the other Starbucks owners? He is the major stockholder. But,
well, they're principally Starbucks is a NASDAQ company, and they're principally institutional investors.
And the stock has been going down.
The stock hit a new low yesterday, and I think I just read in the paper this morning where it's close to a 5-year low. And this is, if you had invested a dollar in Starbucks when he first went public, it would be worth $40 today. I mean, there are many, many Starbucks millionaires. And it's just one more aspect of his great accomplishment. Everybody else made money and fancy new gizmos and electronics and all of this. He was selling the oldest product available, coffee, but he found this new opening and he prospered with it until recently.
And there were other Seattle coffee shops that were doing quite well. Seattle's Best, for example.
Right.
He just found a way to broaden the appeal. Although one of the things I've noticed over the years is that whenever companies do well, they tend to overexpand. And then they wind up incurring a little bit too much debt. I don't know if that's what happened with Starbucks. But then they wind up with a lot of debt. And then there's an economic downturn and they suffer.
Well, they end up as captives of Wall Street in a way. They get bigger and they go public and Wall Street makes its demands. And they demand the expansion that dilutes the brand in a way. It's almost a self-defeating kind of process.
My guest is David Margolik, contributing editor to Condé Nast Portfolio, and his most recent article for the magazine is called Tall Order. It's in the July issue. What kind of leader is he? Is he that as charismatic as he seems to be?
Yeah, he's a very charming and personable guy, and I enjoyed talking to him. He hated the story, and that bothered me, but I personally found him very appealing, very likable. He has a kind of cult of personality around the place. He's very available to his employees. They can write him emails and he answers them all. He's one of these newfangled corporate executives who's very down to earth and very regular and very accessible. And I think the word that you used is right, Leonard. He's a charismatic guy.
On the other hand, perhaps he promises too much, talks a good green case, but then people point out that the company isn't always as green as it might be. He talks about being really loyal to his employees, but then he fought unionization of a store tooth and nail to the point where Daniel Gross, the initiating employee for a store here in Madison Avenue, was fired without even getting a chance to talk to him.
Well, this is one of the interesting aspects of the guy. You know, as I said in the story, the drink that you most often hear associated with Starbucks and Starbucks employees is not venti foam latte. It's Kool-Aid, and swallowing the Kool-Aid. And one of the things that's made him so effective is that he believes his shtick. He believes in himself as a truly enlightened guy, and somebody who's looking out for the best, looking out for his employees and selling. I mean, it's really, as I said in the posting the other day on the website, it's really kind of delusional. It's almost, but he believes it.
And paternalism is not unique to him. This is something that we've seen a lot over the years. Well, I've been so good to my employees.
Well, yeah, but it sort of went out with Henry Ford. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that people would try to get away with now. And yet he feels as if he's found this enlightened capitalism, and he really believes it.
Well, he also is a strong supporter of candidates in the Democratic Party, John Edwards for a while, then Hillary Clinton, now Barack Obama. I would assume that none of them would want to be associated with the anti-union aspect.
Well, you know, you've had a lot of other guests on this show, I'm sure, who've attested to the diminishing power of unions. I mean, I would think that a lot of the people that go to Starbucks, people like you and me, don't like to go to union-breaking places and would never cross a picket line. And that, you know, then again, you know, where did you go for your coffee this morning? You went to Starbucks. I mean, it's surprising to me that people on the Upper West Side and people in Malibu and people in Flint, Michigan, union people, go to Starbucks. But the thing is that I think the demand for coffee trumps the devotion to unions at this point.
How much does a barista earn?
I think they earn barely minimum wage, just a little bit more than minimum wage.
And what about the...
But they're very hard to unionize because they don't stick around for very long. And as I wrote in the piece, they get health benefits, or at least some of them are eligible for health benefits if they work more than a certain number of hours a quarter.
He's been hit by other kinds of lawsuits. Ethiopia accused him of blocking trademark protections for the names of the country's top coffees.
Right. Well, when you scratch the surface, you see that that Starbucks' record in many different sectors is not as lustrous or as honorable as you think it is. But again, they have this image. When you walk into a store, you see the Ethos water, and you see the pictures of coffee growers looking very contented. And they've managed to carry off this image of corporate enlightenment.
Another court case involved forcing baristas to share tips with their supervisors.
Right. This was a case in California in which they're going to have to disgorge many millions of dollars to compensate for them. And
well, why would they even allow that?
You know, I'm not sure why that's the policy. I don't know, but I know that it was a black eye for them. And characteristically, Howard sent out an email to every employee talking about how they're going to fight this tooth and nail and they're going to appeal it. They're not people to back down. And I think that he has, as I found from the reaction to my own story and as I wrote in my story, and he promptly corroborated it, he's a man with very thin skin. And he takes any challenge not only to his managerial wisdom, but to his character, as he takes it as a personal insult.
But he throws around words like authenticity and truth.
Right.
When he speaks, mm-hmm. When you do that sort of thing, then it's much easier to be hoisted by your own.
Oh, absolutely. He invited this sort of thing. I mean, how can you pretend to make the best coffee in the world when, you know, you don't even use baristas traditionally? It's all a push-button process now, you know?
He calls Starbucks items affordable luxuries. Do you think that part of the problem is that people are tightening their belts in this near recession period?
Oh, I think that's the problem. I think that's the principal problem. There are two problems as I see it. I mean, there are...
Well, they raise the prices, and then immediately we heard of a downturn at Starbucks.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are coffee snobs like me who don't go there very often anymore because, in fact, the coffee's not good. The coffee's not as good as it was when they first got started, and it was made manually, made traditionally, made in the way that he wanted to emulate, the Italian way. And then there are the people for whom it's just gotten too costly. And, you know, first of all, the gas is expensive to drive there. And secondly, you know, when people are tightening their belts, it's much easier to go down the road to the 7-Eleven or to Dunkin' Donuts or whatever and get a good cup of black coffee for half the price. And this is you see on the Starbucks gossip website and other places, you see a lot of people saying, I've bought myself an espresso maker and I'm making it at home now. It's cheaper.
To some degree, he's created his own problem, his own competition. And then there are people who argue, Dunkin' Donuts coffee tastes better. I don't know if it does.
It's pretty good.
Now some people are swearing by McDonald's coffee.
But everybody in the coffee business has to acknowledge that Howard Schultz lifted all of their boats. You know, Howard Schultz has been the best thing that ever happened to the coffee business.
What about the introduction of the new Pike Roast? Was that in response to consumer resistance?
Howard felt that traditional drip coffee was an area where Starbucks wasn't getting the credit that it deserved, and they needed to upgrade the blend. And so they invented this Pike Place roast. There are a lot of people.
They're roasting it in every store?
They're not roasting it in every store, no. They're roasting it in regional places and then sending it to the stores. There are a lot of people who don't like Starbucks coffee and never have and felt that it tasted too burned. And this is a response to them. It's a lighter kind of coffee. It tastes more like Dunkin' Donuts coffee. There are other people who feel that was Starbucks' franchise and the Pike Place roast is really Starbucks' version of New Coke. Not a good idea.
At the recent annual stockholders meeting, Schultz admitted that Starbucks has turned from what was once, quote, a culture of entrepreneurship, creativity, and innovation to a culture of, in a way, mediocrity and bureaucracy. With the kind of expansion that Starbucks has gone through, was that unavoidable?
I think it was absolutely inevitable when you grow exponentially in the way that they have. That's the first point. And the second point, of course, is that he presided over it.
But you said that you think that the coffee is not as good as it was. Why is that? Have their standards been lowered?
No, I think that it reminds me of one of my old teachers in boarding school who said, you know, I've seen the meat come in. It's marked grade A. It's in the preparation that it's ruined. I think that the coffee is first class and the roasting and all of that is first class. The problem is that it's mass produced in the stores. And when you mass produce something, it simply can't be as good.
But we've seen this with Whole Foods, for example, where initially it was all about local stuff. And now you can hardly find anything local in a Whole Foods because it's so big.
Right.
The distribution makes it almost impossible to do what made them popular in the first place.
But I think that, you know, you remember those signs in Zabar's that say the meat is kosher until it's sliced. You know, it's all a matter of the way that it's made. And you know, you remember that Starbucks closed for 3 hours to teach people how to make espressos. It was one of Schultz's first, you know, big initiatives when he came back. You don't learn – making espresso is a lifelong skill. You know, I mean, the whole thing about Italian baristas, I mean, these are careers for people. You can't learn in 3 hours, and it's folly to suggest it. And it's also folly to suggest that, you know, coffee that's made by a push button is going to be as good as something that's handcrafted. But that's part of the Starbucks and the Schultzian conceit.
I have to tell you that when I go into a Starbucks and these people order some of these coffee concoctions, I always ask for a small cup of coffee.
Right, right.
That's it.
Right, yeah.
I just want a cup of coffee. Yeah. But that's a whole other aspect of Starbucks that seems to go against the whole authenticity.
Yeah, well, I think this is – he'll tell you that this was something that they never anticipated. But in fact, a lot of people who go to Starbucks don't like coffee. And they do whatever they can to mask the coffee with all of these additives.
And yet one of the major changes we've seen recently is that the emphasis is being placed once again on the coffee.
Yes, ostensibly. But if you go, you know, if you go to a Starbucks, as I did when I was working on the story, I went to the Starbucks on Broadway by Lincoln Center at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And most of the people who went in there were school kids getting these milkshakey concoctions with the syrup on top. I mean, if you can taste the coffee in one of those things, it's a coincidence.
We have very little time, but what do you think is going to happen? 600 stores will be closed. Will that help Starbucks revive itself?
I think that'll help mollify Wall Street. But I think that Starbucks, I think even Schultz will say that Starbucks is in for a difficult time. I mean, there's a story on the front page of the Times today about the problems in the housing market. This goes far beyond Starbucks. Starbucks is really a creature of the American economy. It rose with prosperous times, and it's suffering now because it is a luxury. And I think that until the economy levels off, even Schultz won't be able to right the situation.
But Schultz has done pretty good for a boy who was born in Canarsie, Brooklyn.
It's an amazing story.
David Margalek's story called Tall Orders in the current issue of Condé Nast Portfolio, the July 2008 issue. And you can find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Thanks for coming by, David.
Thank you, Leonard.